Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, Make America Boom Again. Should we do that? I'm not talking about the election. I'm talking about supersonic flight. Since the 1970s, supersonic flight has been banned as the FAA made that decision back in 1973. Maybe they had good reason back then. The planes were not exactly high tech, but it's 2016 and maybe some things have changed, and maybe the FAA should revisit its ban on supersonic flight so that we can travel faster. Joining me to discuss this is Eli Dorado, research fellow at the Mercatus Center. Eli, thanks for joining the show.
Great to be here with you.
So we are recording this on Election Day. This will not be released on Election Day. So your cleverly named paper is not an effort to sway voters one way or the other. I'm pretty sure the candidates have not spoken out about supersonic flight. This is not exactly an election deciding issue, but maybe for those of you who travel a lot, it could be. But Eli, tell us first. How has supersonic flight changed? I mean, let's paint a picture of what it looked like back in the day. You know, the Concorde might come to mind for listeners who are old enough to remember.
Sure. Yeah, the Concorde was basically the only commercial supersonic plane that ever was in service for an extended period of time. There was a Soviet one that briefly operated and turned out to be unsafe, and they pulled it out of service. And then there was there were plans for an American made, Concorde, beginning in the 60s. This was one of, John F. Kennedy's ideas. He asked the FAA to come up with ideas to really improve aviation. And he sort of insisted that we do a Mach 3, 300 passenger, monster plane. Just never worked. Never really got very far, and it was canceled by 1971. So really, the Concorde is it. It was in service from 1976 to about 2003 maybe.
So even though the FAA had banned flights over land in the U.S., the Concorde was allowed to operate because it would only go as far as New York City or D.C., or it didn't really go inland?
Yeah. It only flew supersonic over the ocean. Only over the Atlantic Ocean, in fact, because it didn't have enough fuel to cross the Pacific.
Okay. And what are we talking about in terms of the time saved? So today, let's say, maybe back then it was the same, your average non-supersonic flight to Europe is 7 hours. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about?
It would do 3.5.
So half
yeah,
the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah. So right now subsonic jets are flying, Mach 0.85, and the Concorde would fly up to Mach 2.
Wow.
So, it's more than twice as fast as a subsonic jet.
And who was using this? I mean, most people probably never interacted with the Concorde. I mean, I'm guessing it was expensive.
It was crazy expensive. So the Concorde, it just guzzled fuel. I mean, they used afterburners to get up to the speeds that we're talking about. And that's, you're literally dumping fuel in the back of the engine, sort of as you're flying. So this is incredibly, incredibly fuel efficient. In order to get an efficient supersonic jet, you would need to be able to do it without afterburners, which we can talk about in a minute. It was incredibly expensive. It was associated with very lavish, rich people lifestyle. Sometimes people who were traveling, business or first class, to and from between New York and London, let's say, on British Airways, sometimes you'd get upgraded to the Concorde if you wanted to, because they were always trying to fill out the cabin because not enough people were willing to pay the, $20,000 that it was round trip to go to London. So to go really fast, so they would have to give people upgrades to the Concorde.
So you talked about how it was heavy, it guzzled a lot of fuel, which added to the cost. Was it also subsidy reliant? The only reason this was built and ever used was because government pumped money into it.
Yeah, so this was a project of the British and French government, and a lot of it was political reasons. The UK was trying to play nice with France because they wanted to be part of the European common market.
Look at that. I mean, we're talking about Brexit over the summer.
Yeah.
This is now 40 years ago when they were trying to join the European Union.
Or part of it. And so they, you know, they, that was part of it. There was all kinds of, I mean, literally it was designed by committee, by French and British committee. And they had to have like come to an agreement on whether it was going to be, you know, what parts of it were going to be manufactured in France versus in the UK and all this stuff. So yeah, it was very much a, from the beginning, a government project and a sort of a national greatness project. Similar, you know, in the US, we had the exact same thing going on with our supersonic jet that we wanted to build. It was not really, there was no good economics for doing that. It was just sort of, you know, this is a project that we could do as a, you know, as a country.
Yeah. And it's no shock that I guess someone like JFK might have been a fan because, you know, he wanted us to go to the moon, not because we were going to get rich off of it, because it was a big deal politically, the backdrop of the Cold War. Trying to display your technological superiority was in and of itself a value that politicians saw, even if the technology itself wasn't particularly useful. I mean, yes, you cut the flight time in half, but think about how many Americans either needed that or could afford that. Not so much. So we talked about why it didn't take off back then, right? It was just guzzled fuel, heavy, reliant on subsidies, not particularly in high demand. But four decades have passed, right? We're now in 2016. We see technological marvels everywhere we look, yet flights haven't changed that much. I mean, yes, you now have a little screen with some TV, but when you talk about flying to Europe, the experience is largely the same. And are we ready for a technological leap here? Eli, what has changed since all of these problems we outlined? Is the current landscape for supersonic flight different?
Yeah, I think there's three big technological changes that have happened. So one is just that engines have gotten much more efficient. So basically, using sort of an off-the-shelf jet engine core that is in production today, you can, you know, you'd have to replace the exterior because you would want a lower bypass. But basically, using an off-the-shelf engine core, you can get to super cruise. You can get to, you'd be able to cruise at Mach 2 or maybe even faster, without using afterburners, without, you know, that very wasteful, fuel maneuver. Another thing that's really changed is materials. So, carbon fiber now is basically a commodity, and it's lighter and stronger than what's been used before.
You see that,
aluminum.
Yeah, you see that with some bicycles these days. Right. You pick up a bicycle and it weighs literally like basically nothing. Not literally.
No.
Okay, but
not
basically
literally,
nothing.
But yeah, but close. But it's. I mean, like you can do something that's very very rigid, very strong, and also very 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 lightweight.
And that will cut down on fuel.
And that's exactly right. So you cut down massively on the amount of fuel that you need and the amount of which ultimately translates into the cost of the ticket.
So why did we need a ban in the first place? I mean, if we talk about how crappy the technology was and how useless it was, why was there a ban on this in the 1970s? And then obviously I'm going to ask about the current regulatory challenges, but just first of all, why a ban on something that doesn't even work and no one wants it?
So the ban is, essentially a noise regulation, right? So as you know, when a plane flies faster than the speed of sound, it displaces air in such a way as to create a sonic boom that is observed on the ground. All along the flight path of the airplane, your people along the ground are going to hear a loud boom. And you know, in the 1960s, this was seen as, you know, maybe not that big of a problem. The FAA actually did 6 months of tests over Oklahoma City, where they subjected the residents there to 8 sonic booms a day, pretty loud ones. Turns out that the people, that, you know, they were willing to take it at first to, you know, be good citizens and have the experiment done on them.
Yeah, because there was still that whole air about like technological advancement, and maybe there was some patriotism there, like we are participating in something that will make us cooler than Russia.
Right. So they did that, and it turned out that after a while, the citizens started to revolt and the program had to, that particular experiment had to be canceled. And then, you know, as I said, the FAA was really gung-ho on supersonic during this time because they were in charge of the American SST. So, right. So they were doing everything they could to like show that it could be done over land. In 1971, the SST was canceled. And so and then in 1972, there was a Congress passed a bill just doing, you know, just saying a lot of different, a lot of noise abatement provisions. And one of those was that the FAA was supposed to set a sonic boom, do something about sonic boom, right? It didn't say exactly what to do, but in consultation with the EPA, just do something about, you know, the level of boom. And so the FAA, you know, their project was dead. The SST was dead. And so they made the decision to just completely ban supersonic travel over land. So not like setting a maximum boom noise or saying you couldn't make a boom, which actually would allow you to go Mach 1.1 or so, 1.15 maybe. The boom, you know, wouldn't be experienced on the ground. It was just a complete like speed limit instead of a noise standard.
So have the regulations at all changed in the past 43 years since this ban? And if not, what are you advocating?
So no, they haven't. That particular regulation hasn't changed since 1973. And what my co-author Sam Hammond and I are advocating in our new paper is for the FAA to set a, instead of saying, no, you cannot go faster than this speed, say you cannot make a boom louder than this amount, right? That is felt on the ground. So, you know, it's up would be up to the agency and with input from others on what exactly that level is. You know, we have our ideas of what that should be. But basically what we're saying is, make a noise standard that would allow, you know, some boom over land. And that would, I think, really kickstart a lot of commercially viable supersonic development.
So in the most reasonable sense, you're saying FAA, allow some boom, not full boom. All right. So no one to get too scared.
Not the level of the Concorde, right?
No. Yeah.
So the Concorde had a boom of about 105 decibels, a nominal boom of 105 decibels. And of course, if you know, given certain maneuvers, you could get it up to 135. It's called,
and that would be very disruptive.
That would be extremely disruptive. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, but the nominal boom was 105, which is still like pretty high. I mean, it's loud. And so what we've been saying is, well, let's say we could do it for about 100 times softer, right? And so remember, decibels are a logarithmic scale, so that would be something like 85 decibels as the absolute maximum that you would be allowed to make. And that's, you know, that's comparable to the level of noise that we already tolerate in society in terms of, you know, a motorcycle going down the street or a truck driving by your house or, you know, even your kitchen blender is in the 80s in terms of in terms of the amount of decibels it produces.
Oh, so that's interesting to note that decibels, so 85 is significantly lower than 105. Don't think of it like temperature. It's a little bit more complicated.
I mean, it's 100 times less sound pressure.
Okay, wow. All right, so that's a lot less. So could the industry thrive under the limit that you have proposed? I mean, let's talk about some of the problems that used to plague the industry. Yes, you might be right that the metal is getting lighter and that will lead to less fuel use and that maybe this is a viable technology. People will actually be able to afford it. What about demand? Do people give a crap about this? I mean, it's not like I joked earlier, this is not an issue that people would vote for a candidate over.
Yeah.
Other than you. And I like you a lot and I take your opinion seriously. Yeah. Who else cares about this?
So I think that the community that's been wanting to do this the longest is the business jet manufacturers. And they're the ones that, you know, they've been saying that they want to do this. There's demand for it. Hundreds of planes could be sold, you know, for relatively small jets. And those are actually really good to start on because the boom is a function of the amount of displacement air displacement that you make as you travel. And so a small plane is going to necessarily make a smaller boom than a large plane. And so it's a very natural place to start. And so, there's definitely demand for that. But I've also become aware in the last several months of a startup in Colorado that wants to build an airliner. And they're talking about a 40 passenger airliner, and actually the company's name is Boom, and they're unveiling their prototype next week. So
clearly there is some demand. There are people who want the FAA to make the change, but you could argue that the biggest hurdle is not going to be economics. It's going to be NIMBYism, not in my backyard, right? Yeah. I mean, the whole reason there is this ban in the first place is because they had a little experiment in Oklahoma, and eventually people got pissed. Then they shut down the program and then they banned the noise. So it's probably not unfair to say that the biggest hurdle is going to be just convincing people who have decided to live near airports, or an airport was built there after they'd already lived there, right? There's a difference in that fact pattern. And you guys also did a report, in addition to Make America Boom Again on the supersonic, you guys have been looking at airport noise complaints. And there are some fascinating and absolutely hilarious findings. So can you talk about a little bit about the way that we look at airport noise complaints, how you might hear a number on the news like 60,000 complaints in 1 year, holy shit, but it's not necessarily the full story. So give us a little bit of that, because the two issues are clearly directly related.
So we, with Raymond Russell, I wrote a short paper looking at sort of the empirical distribution of airport noise complaints. So what we found is, for example, here at Reagan, which is the airport closest to us right now, in 2015, there were 8,000 and something total complaints. 6,500 of them were from one individual, and another 300 of them were from that individual's spouse. So two people in the same house in like the Foxhall, Georgetown-ish neighborhood. So not that close to the airport anyway.
For you DC or non-DC residents, we're talking about the airports near Alexandria, Virginia, which is south of the heart of Washington, D.C. Yeah. Georgetown is on the western portion of D.C., closest to Virginia. So we're talking about like a 30-minute drive away from the area about.
I don't think it's that far, but it's like a good, 4 miles away from the airport, and I live like 2 miles away, from the airport, as the crow flies, and, it seems okay. I'm not right under a flight pattern. Right. And so on. And there have been changes in the routes, in the last couple of years as the FAA has implemented a better, air traffic management system. But they're not particularly close to the airport, and they're responsible for close to 80% of the complaints.
And I have this right. It's 6,800 complaints from one household in 1 year.
Yes.
How is that even? Listeners, just think about how, if you even wanted to do something like that, like if you set out to get that number of complaints, you're talking multiple complaints per day.
Yeah, I think like on an average 19 a day.
That's kind of crazy.
So somebody, sitting down and every, 40 minutes or so they're, during their waking hours, they're sitting down in front of a computer or whatever and submitting a detailed complaint, like saying, this was the noise that I heard and so on. It's basically a full-time job. Yeah. That someone is taking it upon themselves.
So we might be dealing with actually crazy people, but the problem is, and someone pointed this out to me recently after they heard about your report, they said on the news, the reporter might just get the total number of complaints in a year and be like, there were 8,000 complaints in a year, which sounds like a lot, but when are they actually, is the FAA going to recognize that these complaints are mostly from people who might not even live near the airport. Right. They might be a little crazy. I mean, how has the response been to your paper and your findings about noise complaints? And do you think that the reception spells a good future for supersonic flight or not?
So I think it's gotten a lot of attention, which, I'm gratified to see. I think most people they look at the data and they kind of see it our way, and they're just like, well, this is a little nuts, and we shouldn't, you know, we need to be careful not to overweight these people's opinion. You know, on the other hand, you know, a lot of people, there have been a small number of people who have repeatedly complained, let's put it that way, about our paper.
Yeah. So it's almost like the people who complain about noise at the airport might also be complaining about your paper about noise at the airport.
Repeatedly and vociferously. yeah. So, you know, on one hand, the point is, you know, has been raised that, you know, a lot of there is a silent majority that isn't complaining, but they also, you know, feel the same way. That's one view that I've heard. Another is, you know, that it really is bad, right? Like, you know, you need to hear how loud it is. It's really insane.
Right, so it's still the NIMBY argument, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be a challenge, clearly. I mean, to close out the show, do you have any sense of when Americans might be seeing developments in this space, when we might see testing, companies really starting to hit the ground? I mean, what do you think is going to happen here? Are there efforts to legislatively make this fix? Would the next FAA be looking at this? I mean, just kind of give us a sense of where the future's going.
Sure. So as I said, I think Boom out in Colorado will be unveiling their subscale prototype next week. And they plan to do testing with that the end of next year, so about 12 months from now.
They need a regulatory change to do the testing, or they can do that?
No,
anyway.
they can do the testing in cooperation with the Air Force or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
So they'll be able to do that. Again, they're targeting primarily the transoceanic market, just like the Concorde did. In terms of the when will that come to market? You know, if it does, I'm thinking, you know, within five to eight years, something like that, that kind of time range, that you'll be able to hopefully take a transoceanic flight, you know, faster than the speed of sound. In terms of the overland ban, I think really this is only gonna, the FAA has said that they were thinking about doing this as far back as 2011, but there's been zero public facing work on it since then. So I think really this is going to happen only if Congress says something. So, what I'm hoping is that we'll see some legislation in the next year, either as part of the FAA reauthorization that has to happen by the end of September next year, or maybe some standalone legislation.
And that's really interesting because the FAA reauthorization is obviously an opportunity for a lot of things, drones,
yes,
flight sharing, things we've talked about on the show before, and now yet another thing.
And that's the only way that innovation really happens with the FAA, right? The FAA is a safety agency, safety first, safety always.
Right.
And so they don't like change. They don't like a lot of, you know, too much innovation.
Right.
And so it really is up to Congress to sort of put the pressure on the agency and actually just have mandates to do things as they did with drones, right? They set a deadline for when they had to adopt commercial drones.
Just imagine if those folks who are able to call about airport noise every day, multiple times a day, redirected their efforts to telling people to legalize supersonic flight. That'd be an interesting thing. But we'll certainly be looking out for how this develops, and we'll definitely have Eli back on the show to update us as needed. Eli, thanks so much. Research fellow at the Mercatus Center.
Yeah, thanks so much, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Feel free to pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please, please, please leave us a review because it will help others find the show, and we like getting your feedback. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.